Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, there is more focus on fluoride in drinking water. It's considered a public health success story that has prevented tooth decay among generations. But some studies raise concerns. With RFK Jr. picked to head the Department of Health and Human Services, could fluoride be reduced or removed? We'll take a closer look. As a second Trump administration prepares to take over, we hear what some in Illinois are thinking about two key issues, tariffs and immigration. Illinois could be getting a new state flag, and we'll talk with a member of the Illinois Flag Commission. And also have the story of a school crossing guard who has been doing that job for three decades. The city of Chicago is using renewable solar energy to power government buildings, and that power is being generated in central Illinois. We'll also visit with the musician Sean Colvin, who grew up in southern Illinois. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, when you pour a glass of water from your tap, it is likely that glass is a small therapeutic dose of fluoride. But that could change. Donald Trump's pick to head the Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., says he wants fluoride out of the U.S. water system. Ben Thorpe with Side Effects Public Media says some health experts are worried, while others see emerging research may back up that effort.
Donald Xi was surprised to hear fluoride had become part of a U.S. presidential campaign.
It's really rare for someone, who has influence at the federal level to take a stand on an issue that directly affects oral health.
Xi is an associate dean for research in the School of Dentistry at the University of Washington and says that fluoride has been a staple of oral medicine for roughly 80 years.
So every time you drink tap water that's fluoridated, you get that protection from cavities.
It's likely water fluoridation has saved many of us from multiple painful dentist visits since the government added it to the water in the 1940s. It was so successful that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention dubbed it one of the greatest public health interventions of the 20th century. Now, roughly 200 million Americans receive fluoridated water from a community water system. So, what would happen if fluoride was removed? If you brush your teeth twice a day with fluoride toothpaste and don't eat a lot of carbs and sugars, you might not notice a big difference. But for many people, that's not the case.
Particularly, it makes a difference for people who have difficulty with toothbrushing.
That's James Dickinson. He's a professor of community health sciences at the University of Calgary in Canada.
And it makes a difference for everybody at all ages.
His city voted to end the use of fluoride in drinking water. It was a natural experiment of sorts, and the result was clear.
There's a steady increase in the amount of rotten teeth, and that means children who have multiple fillings, yeah. Children who need general anesthetic to have major tooth surgery.
But emerging science has begun to indicate some risks associated with fluoride at high levels. A federal health agency released findings from an 8-year review of studies mostly outside the U.S. The agency concluded that it had moderate confidence that fluoride at levels roughly double those found in U.S. water systems could be associated with lower IQ in children. The American Academy of Pediatrics pushed back against this review and questioned its validity. But that review is not the only report to show such an association. Ashley Mollin worked on one of those studies. She's an epidemiologist at the University of Florida. And she says,
the concentration needs to be reduced in community water or that the practice needs to be ended altogether.
Mollin studied urine samples from pregnant women in Los Angeles. She looked at total fluoride exposure, not just from drinking water. Her study found an association with negative impacts on children's behavioral health.
And so this is an association that we observed. It doesn't necessarily mean that it was that it's causal, but it is consistent with numerous other studies published in North America.
Mollin says the research is increasingly pointing to a trade-off between health risk and health benefits. But most dental experts say it is far too soon to make changes to public health policy. Xi, with the School of Dentistry at the University of Washington, says there would be clear consequences for removing fluoride, and we need more studies to determine how much risk is posed by the dose of fluoride added to water.
Rarely is one study going to definitively tell us all the answers we need to make, you know, a decision. So science is cumulative.
In the meantime, Chi says, the onus will be on public health experts to explain the latest science that recommendations are based on to the American people. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Ben Thorpe.
The president-elect is proposing more tariffs for his second term. Jim Meadows looks at what four more years of a Trump administration could mean for local farmers.
J.C. Reitmeier is a corn and soybean farmer in central Illinois. He's also the outgoing co-president of the Champaign County Active Senior Republicans, which celebrated Donald Trump's election victory at a recent meeting. Many in the group are looking forward to Trump's return to the White House. Reitmeier said the new Trump administration will face a big challenge when it tries to bring up prices for his crops.
A lot of the big buyers have gone to South America and other countries to get their corn and soybeans, and we're kind of in the dust again. We're just going to have to get our exports built back up.
Illinois is the number one state in the nation for producing soybeans and number two for corn. A large share of those crops are sold to other countries, notably China, which is the largest buyer of U.S. soybeans and third largest buyer of its corn. But when the Trump administration imposed tariffs on Chinese goods in 2018, China retaliated with tariffs on U.S. crop exports, especially soybeans. Joe Jansen is an agricultural economist at the University of Illinois. He says the tariffs caused Chinese buyers to look elsewhere.
What we saw at that time was prices for soybeans in the United States went down. Prices for soybeans in other parts of the world, particularly Brazil, went up.
Brazil surpassed the U.S. in soybean exports to China about a decade ago, and the U.S.-China trade war only widened the gap. And if new tariffs are imposed and China continues to retaliate, Brazil is ready to take even more of the USA's market share. That's according to U of I Ag Economics researcher Joanna Caluzzi.
If China would like to buy more soybeans from South America to replace the amount of soybeans that they would buy here in the U.S., given the numbers so far or given the situation until now, South America will be able to match this demand.
Despite gains for some U.S. industries like steel and aluminum, a review by the Tax Foundation, a generally pro-tax cut think tank, concluded that tariffs under Presidents Trump and Joe Biden have had a net negative impact on the U.S. economy. In a December news conference, Trump repeated his belief that tariffs could be an effective tactic for working out bilateral trade deals with other countries.
I always said, to me, tariffs are the most beautiful word in the dictionary. It'll make our country rich. You go back and look at the 1890s, 1880s, McKinley, and you take a look at tariffs. That was when we were at our proportionately the richest.
I, again, respectfully disagree with the incoming president.
That's Ryan Whitehouse with the Illinois Farm Bureau. He and other Midwest farm groups say tariffs on imported goods will hurt everyday Americans.
When you add cost to something, someone's got to pay for that. And whether that be solely by the consumer or even a partial share with the producer and the manufacturer and the consumer is still paying more.
Back in Champaign County, farmer J.C. Reitmeier maintains his faith in Donald Trump, but
I'm not sure if tariffs are going to do it. Tariffs are a bad thing in my point of view.
Reitmeier thinks the talk about tariffs is mostly hype, and he hopes it stays that way, at least when it comes to agricultural commodities and the crops he grows. I'm Jim Meadows.
Donald Trump has promised to start mass deportations. In Illinois, almost 8% of K-12 students have an undocumented parent, according to Pew Research data. So what can these families do if their children are worried about what will happen to them? Illinois Public Media's Emily Hayes has more.
Maria Jimenez remembers when Donald Trump was first elected in 2016.
I remember sitting in the kitchen with my parents and just sobbing.
Jimenez is a 27-year-old leader in Champaign-Urbana immigration nonprofits and uses she and they pronouns. They have lived in the United States since they were 3 years old. They moved from Costa Rica on visas with their parents and brothers. They thought it would be simple to get citizenship, but it wasn't. The visas expired and the entire family of five became undocumented.
So much fear becomes a normal part of our lives. Seeing your parents in fight or flight is just how you see them.
They say Donald Trump's first term took those emotions to a new level.
It was a time of extreme fear for my family, of like having to go straight into planning, like what would it look like if some of us got deported or if our parents got deported.
It's a question that Jimenez and a lot of other families with young children are asking themselves again. But when it comes to deportations, Illinois offers legal protections that other states don't. In 2017, former Republican Governor Bruce Rauner signed the TRUST Act. It prevents local police from stopping, arresting, or detaining someone based on their immigration status. And Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker signed additional protections into law in 2019. That includes blocking law enforcement agencies from working with Immigration and Customs Enforcement to turn local police into ICE agents.
They cannot ask about immigration status.
That's Janice Jays. She teaches history at Illinois State University and has long been involved in immigration groups in Champaign-Urbana.
If you call because you've been a victim of a crime or something, you're not in danger. You know, and that obviously there's an interest in making sure that the police are able to provide for general security without people worrying about immigration status.
Still, she says area schools and nonprofits have been hosting workshops ahead of Trump's second term to help families learn about their rights and what to do if they are questioned.
Part of that is gathering together the kinds of information, you know, whether it's medical records or school or phone numbers of friends or relatives.
And they're helping families sign guardianship papers.
In the event that the parents were arrested, that there would be a guardian appointed, that they already had the paperwork done and notarized. And that was very emotional for everybody involved. But that is something that they are preparing for.
The families are told to put it all in an envelope and put it in a place the kids know about so they would know who to call. And if families do get deported, their destination country may be safer than when they first left. Rena Torres Mendeville runs the Mexican consulate in Chicago.
If for any circumstances you find yourself back in Mexico, we want to make sure that you find the support there.
She says her office is coordinating with state governments in the country so those moving back can decide whether to return to their hometowns, learn how to register for public schools, open a Mexican bank account, and more.
The largest portion of our clients are asylum seekers.
Maria Jimenez has grown from a scared teen during Trump's first election into the Associate Director of the Immigration Services of Champaign-Urbana. Unlike their parents who are looking for economic stability, their clients tend to be fleeing something specific.
We're talking about high rates of domestic violence, of human trafficking, right? We're talking about fleeing poverty to the point that you're eating out of rusted pans.
Heading into the next 4 years, Jimenez is also concerned about their own status. They're a dreamer under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Trump repealed DACA in his first term, though it was reinstated by a court order. Those around Jimenez are urging them to marry their longtime partner, an American citizen, in case it is threatened again.
I don't just want to get married just because it's like the legal thing to do.
Conversations are also ongoing about just exactly what President-elect Trump's plans are. Jimenez hopes to validate clients' fears and prepare for all the possibilities while taking one day at a time and not giving into fear. That's the main advice they want to give to undocumented kids.
There's a reason we're called dreamers, and not being afraid to dream is a huge piece of it, of knowing you're just as worthy and just as entitled to going out into the world and creating something for yourself.
I'm Emily Hayes with IPM News.
Well, the state of Illinois may soon get a new flag. Members of the public have submitted nearly 5,000 designs to the State Flag Commission, ranging from stars and stripes to Abraham Lincoln shooting lasers out of his eyes. The commission, made up of 21 artists, educators, historians, and fans, has whittled the pool down to their top 10 picks. Mawa Iqbal sat down with Commissioner Will Stevens to learn more about what went into the process.
You all had to pick your 10 favorite designs from a pool of nearly 5,000 submissions. So tell me more about that process.
So what happened is we had a meeting where I think there were something like 150 designs commission members had selected. Any flag in the first round to advance had to have at least three people advocate for it. That cut it down to 30, and then we took those 30 and put each one up on the board, and for a flag to advance, it had to have five people advocate for it. And after two rounds is how we came to the final 10. There was a lot of stuff turned in that had the skyline of the city of Chicago in it, and I think a lot of the folks from Central Illinois and Southern Illinois said, all due respect to Chicago, but we don't think that that is a state flag that looks like a new Chicago flag. And some of the things that focus too heavily on rural things, Chicago representatives would say, you know, that looks like a great flag for Southern Illinois, but maybe not a great flag for the whole state. And I think that that's the reason why you see a lot of Lincoln, you see a lot of stars, you see a lot of things that some people are calling bland, but in reality, we were trying to hone in on things that wouldn't be criticized as being too regional.
Are you happy with the final 10 designs?
I don't know if I'd say I'm happy. I would say that I'm satisfied that we did the best we could with what we had. Me personally, I've never had a problem with the flag that we have. I think that sometimes enduring symbols become enduring because you leave them alone.
So tell me about some of the weirdest, most out there submissions.
I remember one person submitted a pack of cigarettes. There was a person that, you know, various people that submitted flags that had Governor Pritzker like riding a dinosaur or something, or Abraham Lincoln with like radioactive looking eyes.
Okay, and finally, out of the top 10, which flag is your favorite?
The Illinois flag that we have currently has Lake Michigan. And when the Illinois flag flies in the wind, you know, those waves of the lake ripple and the wings of the eagle, to me, sort of come alive. I mean, the Illinois seal is not a staid sort of emblem. I mean, there's a lot of living things in it, the water, the sun, the eagle, the pennant in the eagle's mouth. And I feel like for all the criticism of the current state flag, adding a couple of other design elements to it, removing the word Illinois, I think that flag could have some durability, but also sort of freshen it up.
The Illinois Flag Commission's Will Stevens speaking with Mawa Iqbal. Public voting on the top 10 creations closes February 14th. The commission will then send recommendations to the General Assembly by the start of April, and lawmakers will then decide to either adopt a new flag or keep the current iteration. This is Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The city of Chicago is meeting a longtime climate goal. The city's municipal buildings are sourcing electricity from 100% renewable energy. It's part of a years-long effort to wean Chicago off of fossil fuels, and that renewable energy is being generated in central Illinois near Springfield. Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco has details.
It's a cold, windy morning in downtown Chicago, and Angela Tovar crosses LaSalle.
We have police stations, we have fire stations.
She's the head of the city's Department of Environment, and she's listing off buildings that will soon only get their energy from renewables.
We have libraries, we have buildings that provide city services.
Like this one, City Hall.
We're walking in, and the first thing that you're met with here in City Hall is probably this, 10-foot-tall holiday tree?
That tree's lights, the Wi-Fi, the computers, everything in City Hall will source its electricity from primarily solar energy. The same goes for over 400 municipal buildings across town.
The city is transitioning to 100% renewable energy.
City officials say the move will cut Chicago's carbon footprint by approximately 290,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide each year. That's the equivalent of taking 62,000 cars off the road. It's all part of an agreement the city struck back in 2022 to curb the city's carbon emissions, not just by purchasing renewable energy, but by leveraging the city's buying power to help finance new renewable energy projects.
The second largest renewable energy deal here by any single city in the U.S., and it's the largest municipal deal that's truly bringing on new renewable energy onto the grid versus contracting for existing renewable energy.
That's Matthew Popkin with the Rocky Mountain Institute, a clean energy think tank. He provided technical assistance to help the city finalize the agreement. Here's how it works. Electric customers in Illinois get to choose exactly who they buy their electricity from. And when the customer is as big as Chicago, they have room to negotiate. the city decided it didn't want to just rely on existing solar. They wanted to help the state create more. So they signed a deal that helped finance what is now the largest solar farm east of the Mississippi River. It's called the Double Black Diamond Solar Project, and it spans two counties in central Illinois and has a capacity of 597 megawatts, about half of which is contracted to Chicago for the next 5 years.
It's a plan that gets the city to take a significant action on climate and also leverages our buying power to generate new opportunities both for Chicagoans and across the state.
The company building the solar farm, Swift Current Energy, says the two downstate counties hosting the installation will see some $100 million in additional tax revenue during the operational life of the project. And back in Chicago, Swift Current and Constellation, the company that will deliver the electricity to the city, have agreed to fund local workforce programs for clean energy jobs. While most of the city's energy will be sourced from the downstate solar farm, the rest, about 30%, will be purchased through renewable energy credits. But the hope is that eventually, that 30% will spur the development of other, smaller-scale clean energy projects locally. Popkin from the Rocky Mountain Institute again.
Chicago is demonstrating directly how cities can lead by example, implement ambitious goals amidst evolving state and federal policy changes, and leverage their purchasing power to support a more equitable renewable energy future.
He says he hopes more cities will follow Chicago's lead, particularly as the industry braces for coming cuts in federal support for clean energy. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, WBEZ News.
The Double Black Diamond Solar Project is located near the town of Waverly. It includes property in Sangamon and Morgan counties. A lot of black, brown, and low-income students in Illinois who need a college degree to move up in the world go to for-profit colleges to get one. These companies promise a fast track to graduation and a better job, one you can do while working the job you already have or raising your kids. But an investigation by member station WBEZ found these schools too often leave students worse off than when they started. Lisa Curry and Phillip reports.
Try to keep it nice and clean in here.
After her kid gets on the bus to school, Nika Ewing gets into her car and eventually starts it up.
We gotta do this quite a few times before.
She has just a few hours to make some money picking up and delivering food orders.
One day you'll have it to where as soon as you turn the app on, it's like ding, 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 ding.
It was supposed to be a side hustle while she worked on her software engineering degree at DeVry University. It's a for-profit college chain with campuses across the country.
And then another time you turn on the app and they're giving you like $2 order, $3 orders. I'm not even making gas with that. That's why I'm like, DeVry, something gotta come because I can't keep living like this.
Ewing was pregnant with her first daughter when she saw a commercial on her local news channel for DeVry. It offered the option to get a bachelor's degree in 3 years and promised job placement within 6 months after that. 5 years and tens of thousands of dollars in student loans later, Ewing still doesn't have the degree or a job and is stuck dropping off other people's takeout.
I'm like, so where I'm going? Like, what y'all got lined up for me? And then I was told it was not that at all. So I was like, okay. You know, you feel kind of bamboozled a little bit.
Low-income students and black students like Ewing attend for-profit colleges in Illinois at much higher rates than other groups. WBEZ analyzed federal education data. We found that two-thirds of for-profit schools in Illinois reported their students make less money than a high school graduate. We also surveyed 250 current and former students. We heard that all too often, these schools leave students in low-wage jobs, struggling under mountains of student debt. Aisa Contreras is policy director for the Student Borrower Protection Center.
The for-profit kind of playbook is to meet these communities where they are, capitalize on those lack of infrastructure, lack of funding, lack of opportunities, and then dangle that promise of economic security, economic stability, economic mobility to these same folks. The results are catastrophic.
Dominique Baker is a higher education researcher at the University of Delaware. She says for-profit schools give the perfect pitch. Take this commercial for DeVry.
A bachelor's degree from DeVry University could change your tomorrow if you do something today.
With our people in those ads have children. They are more often older. And those ads frequently have Black women more often than other institutions' ads do. So in every sort of way, these for-profit institutions are creating an image of being incredibly welcoming to Black women in particular.
Once students are rushed through the door, the bottom often drops out. For-profits spend so much on advertising, there's not much left for what happens in the classroom. DeVry did not respond to a request for an interview. Some students who filled out our survey had positive experiences with the school. Federal officials are introducing new rules to crack down on training programs, those that leave students with a ton of debt and not enough income to pay it back could lose access to federal funding. But that's too little and too late for Ewing. She recently took on work as a house cleaner.
They tell you, oh, in order to get a better job, you need to get an education. You get an education, and that still ain't enough.
Ewing has more than $60,000 in student loans and no idea how she'll pay it back.
I'm Lisa Corian-Phillip.
Collard greens are a staple for many households during the holidays, but the majority of collards sold at grocery stores are one of just a few varieties. There is an effort underway to change that and get tastier and heartier collard greens onto people's plates. Kate Grumke with Harvest Public Media takes us to a greenhouse in East St. Louis.
Rows of hundreds of collard greens are evenly planted at the Jackie Joyner Kersey Food, Agriculture, and Nutrition Innovation Center. These collards look surprisingly different from each other and from what you would typically find in a grocery store.
Some of these are really, really smooth when you look at leaf edges. Some of these are more curly leaf edges like kale.
That's Antonio Brazelton, a PhD candidate at Washington University in St. Louis. There are even big differences in the colors of these collards. Many are a deep green, but some are more yellow. A few leaves have purple veins.
As varied as they are above ground, they're also doing some really cool things below ground.
Brazelton studies the roots of collard greens and wants to know how differences might affect things like taste and hardiness amid climate change. But these aren't just any collard greens. These are heirloom varieties that have been passed down for generations. Brazelton puts a paper label on a collard.
We'll essentially tag this guy and say, you look like a plant that we should definitely take roots for.
After years dreaming up this project, in just a couple days, he'll dig up the plant to learn what's going on underground. These seeds have been on an interesting journey to Brazelton's greenhouse. Many were first collected by Ed Davis, a geographer and scholar of agriculture at Emory and Henry University in Virginia. Almost 20 years ago, Davis and some colleagues drove thousands of miles around the southeastern U.S. looking for unique collard greens.
We would pull up to a house and say, excuse me, I think you've got some interesting collards there. Those don't look like they were store-bought seed. Usually people would just beam with pride.
The seeds ended up in a bank run by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Now, a group of collard enthusiasts are working on preserving those varieties and getting them onto people's plates through the Heirloom Collard Project. Ira Wallace is known as the godmother of this effort. She's a worker owner of Southern Exposure Seed Exchange in Virginia. Wallace says the Heirloom Collard Project is lifting up a vegetable that is both extremely nutritious and has a rich historical and cultural significance for African Americans.
And it has a tie to history, to people's families, to going back south in the summer.
Wallace says Brazelton's work in East St. Louis is part of a long tradition of African-American science and agriculture, work that's epitomized by researchers like George Washington Carver and historically Black colleges and universities.
I think of this as the modern child of that early work, which got a little bit interrupted with the great migration of Black people from the South to the North, but it's amazing.
And she says it's especially important amid climate change. At the Jackie Joyner Kersey Center, it's finally time to dig up these plants. A team of people are at the greenhouse to help Brazelton. First, they break off the collard leaves to weigh. Next, they dig the roots up and wash them off so Brazelton can get images of them in a portable plant photo booth. He says it's surreal to get to this point after working toward it for years.
I feel like I might be a root scientist now, today.
Brazelton envisions a direct impact for the science behind his project.
Hopefully this leads to an opportunity to have more of a community-led, community-focused breeding initiative around these collards that comes out of this.
For now, the collards are headed to the community through food pantries and an after-school program. And Brazelton says a few will come home with him. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Kate Grumke.
Crossing guards are an essential part of any school. They safely shepherd students through busy intersections. They're essential, but often underappreciated. Peter Medlin spent a morning with a crossing guard in Sandwich, who's been at it for 30 years and definitely does not go unnoticed.
On a cold, snowy morning in Sandwich, Illinois, an elementary schooler smiles as a penguin helps her cross the street in front of her school. Well, a person in a penguin costume. It's Louise Klassen. She's been a crossing guard here on the corner of Wells and Lyons for over 3 decades now, and every day she's here in a costume or a special hat.
Many people have said that. They look forward to coming by my corner to see what I'm wearing because it kind of starts their day out right. Because sometimes it's difficult. I'm sure for them.
And people are happy to see the penguin this morning. Thanks to the bitter weather, there aren't a ton of kids walking to school today, but almost every car has a smile and wave for her. Over the years, Klassen's collected more than 50 costumes.
And then how many hats?
415.
Yeah. 415 hats, everything from a pumpkin pie Thanksgiving hat to a hat made of tin cans, and she's got a hat or costume for just about every holiday, too, and the costumes aren't just fun, they're also educational.
In September, it's Constitution Day. I have a Thomas Jefferson outfit that I wear that day. If I can find a history hat that relates, then I try to bring that.
She's got Civil War hats she wears on April 9th, the anniversary of General Lee surrendering to the Union in Appomattox. She's also got a custom Veterans Day hat that was gifted to her. She's gotten a lot of presents over the years. In fact, the penguin costume itself was a gift from a family that drives by her corner every day. She's gotten hats, a student made her a little cardboard stop sign, and they draw her pictures.
One of the kids that go by my corner drew that for me. I'm holding up a stop sign. He thinks I'm an angel.
And Klassen gives out her own gifts, too.
I give a dollar and a card at a Christmas card for all the kids. And then 8th grade graduation, the card and $5. And then at high school, the ones that have crossed my corner, when they graduate, I give them a card and $10.
She watches families grow up from her intersection. She also likes to go to her students' sports games and support them. It's all made Klassen a beloved part of the community. And that status was made formal years ago when the school district asked her to be Grand Marshal of the Homecoming Parade. And it even came with its own hat, a cowboy hat with a blue bandana that reads Grand Marshal.
This is my favorite because it was given by the kids. And they asked me to be Grand Marshal. And it just that was just very touching. They asked me again, too, but I had to turn them down because I told them I've already been Grand Marshal.
Her journey started 31 years ago while she was working as a secretary at Haskin Elementary, which sits just a few yards from her intersection. The crossing guard quit, and she asked if she could fill in before her shift and fell in love with the job. Ever since, she's been greeting and building relationships with the kids and their guardians who walk and drive by. Klassen says she feels like this. Starting kids' days off with joy, one hat at a time, is her calling.
I tell people I have the best job in the world, you know, because the kindness and generosity, and I've never had a problem with any of the parents or children, or I'm not hassled at all.
Good.
Which is nice.
Just over 30 years in, even though she carries a stop sign every day, she's got no plans of stopping, even when it means bundling up in 10 layers plus a penguin costume. Klassen's hoping to make it all the way to 50 years if she can. In some ways, the four-way stop at Lyons and Wells is as much her home as her real house.
I told my husband to put the hat lady on my tombstone, so...
She's got an animal-themed month, a Roy Rogers-inspired cowboy costume week, and sandwich gear for homecoming week. But no matter which of the 415 hats you see Klassen in, her joyful smile and wave is sure to start your day off right. I'm Peter Medlin.
Still on the way, a conversation with musician Sean Colvin, who got her start here in Illinois. That's ahead on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Sean Colvin gained popularity with the 1990s hit Sonny Came Home, but she's been playing music much longer and she's still at it. She grew up in Carbondale and played local venues while attending Southern Illinois University. Now in her late 60s, Colvin is once again on tour. As she spoke with NPR about the challenges she's faced in the music industry and how she found her voice.
Sean Colvin, thank you for joining us.
That's my pleasure.
Oh, what a great pleasure for us to be with you. We're in the Birchmere Theater in Alexandria, Virginia, one of my favorite places, about 2 miles from where my wife and I, our family, used to live.
Is that right?
It is. A nice, cozy venue. Mm. And I just want to ask you, you say you want to play like it's your living room. So much of your music is about your feelings, your emotion, your spirituality. Anything you want to play a few bars for us now that is about your living room, that kind of a sound?
Sure. Sure. This one actually was nothing like I thought it was going to be. I often co-write with a fellow named John Leventhal.
Yes, yeah. You were together with him in New York for several years, yeah?
Several years, yes. And even after I moved to Texas, we would manage to make records. This is one of them. It was called These Four Walls, is the name of the record. And he gave me this piece of music, if I can get in tune. And it's so pretty, I was kind of scared to write anything to it. The night before, I had to go in the studio and deliver this song, which I hadn't written lyrics to. And I was in New York, and I started watching TV, yep. And there was a great program on Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and and I just had to watch it rather than work on the song, you know? I'm like, what's more important here?
We all do other stuff, right? We have deadlines, but I want to do something else. Just procrastinate.
Correct. So I had to go in the studio next day with nothing, and I started writing the lyrics to this song, and I thought it would be a love song or something. And it was inspired by the MLK program I'd seen the night before, so let's see. Before you knew me, an angel came to me. I wrestled him down to the ground. He said he could cure me. I said, don't worry me now. 'Cause those angels just bore me the same old damn story. They were lost, oh, but now they've been found. There ain't nobody looking but don't worry. So I wrote it in the first person. Which is, you know, it's a little dark, but on the same hand, it's not. So I was inspired by that program.
Well, you've talked in interviews about the process of finding your own voice and your kind of writing your songs, writing your lyrics.
Yeah.
And in some cases, the challenges of it. And my goodness, I understand that. I've written one book so hard.
Yeah.
And people say, and I write for radio, and they say, you know, just, you know, keep writing and you'll find your voice. Like it's a penny in the ground. You're going to find your voice. It is so hard. How easy or hard for you was it for you to find your voice?
It wasn't easy at all. I was such a good copycat, and I made money in cover bands. I didn't really think it would ever happen. And then I met John Leventhal in New York. And
in the 80s, yeah?
Yeah, early 80s. Mm-hmm. Right, probably met him in 81, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But initially, the first song I wrote with John, he gave me the music. It was fully produced. And I thought, this is never going to work unless I transpose it, deconstruct it down to just an acoustic guitar. And it was Diamond in the Rough. And I played it, and I swear to God, if John had said, I don't get it, I don't think I'd have kept going.
And thankfully,
he said, I think you got something. keep going.
You play a little of that for us?
Yeah, sure.
You find your voice. Of course, Sonny came home, multiple Grammys. Mm. But is it true that by that time in the 90s, radio DJs did not want to play two women in a row?
Absolutely
true. That's crazy.
No kidding.
So that was the world you were in.
Yeah, and then I followed up a hit record with getting pregnant, and that was the death knell.
What do you mean?
Well, you have a hit record, you better get on it and do another record ASAP. Uh-huh. And I didn't. They just saw the writing on the wall in terms of how fast I was going to get another record done.
That so when you say happening. They, this is the marketers?
Who it's is Columbia they? Records.
Okay.
Who built me a career.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, the next record came out and it was like I was invisible. So I got off the label. I'm like, I don't want to be here, you know. Mm. It was crushing.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're so honest when you talk about your career, your life. In interviews, you've talked about your challenges with addiction and becoming sober and staying sober. You know, I've been to a number of 12-step meetings where, you know, so many participants say, I got to get out of my own head. Right, it's not about me. I need to listen to other people's stories.
Yeah.
This challenge is bigger than me. And I just need to be around people who are fighting the same fight that I am. And I wonder if any of that resonates with your experience, your songwriting.
Yeah. Community. Speaking the same language, as I was able to kind of shed some old roles that I'd been put into from my family and developed a community and if you will, a family that was truer. There are people in my family who wouldn't like me to say that. And it's hard to say it because I know that, but that's the truth.
Well, speaking of family, the story, your song, The Story.
Yeah. I hope my mother doesn't hear this.
It's about your family and the dysfunction in your family. You said that, you know, some members of your family appreciate it. Your mother hated it, didn't appreciate it. But was it important for you to take these realities and write them and perform them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was an amalgamation of things I'd worked hard on and learned. Diamond in the Rough's about that. Mm. The Story obviously is about that. So no, she didn't like it. In fact, I played the song at the bottom line when the record got released, and when I started playing The Story, she walked out and then came back in when it was over. So, but my dad said, write anything you want. Mm. So that was a big difference between them. I kind of went with my dad.
Coming back to your voice, when you listen back to your songs, is there one where you're like, this is my voice, this is it?
All of them.
Pick one?
Play one.
Okay. So one thing I really am proud of in this song, which is not to say that I'm not proud of the songs I co-wrote with John or anybody else, but I wrote this one by myself. Mm. And it kind of wouldn't stop writing itself. So it was a real gift. So. Please no more therapy, mother, take care of me, piece me together with a needle and thread, wrap me in eiderdown, lace from your wedding gown, fold me and lay me down on your bed, or liken me to a shoe, blacken and spit on through, kicking back home to you, smiling back home, just singing back home to you, laughing back home to you, dragging back home to you.
Oh, I love that song.
Thank you. Yeah, that was, I felt like, okay, I did something special here, so.
Well, you're about to go live at the Birchmere Theater here in Alexandria, Virginia. Sean Colvin, thank you so much for the time. What a pleasure.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
A measure filed in the Indiana State House would explore letting secession-minded Illinois counties join the Hoosier State. The bill creates the Indiana-Illinois Boundary Adjustment Commission. Indiana House Republicans say it's one of their top legislative priorities this year. The sponsor is the Indiana House Speaker, Todd Houston. He told the Indianapolis Star fed-up Illinoisans should join a, quote, low-cost, low-tax state instead of forming a new one. But Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker scoffed at the idea. He calls Indiana a low-wage state.
I don't think that it's very attractive for anybody in Illinois, where wages are higher, where the standard of living is higher, and where we do provide health care for people who are in need.
The Indiana bill targets the nearly three dozen Illinois counties where voters have said they'd like to secede. Both states would need to approve boundary changes. There seems to be no appetite to do that among top Illinois leaders. Most typing is done quietly, on a computer, keyboard, or phone. But as Jonathan All reports, a couple in Rolla, Missouri, have opened a business they hope will spur interest in a much older way to put words on a page.
Shane Burns stumbled into an antique shop in Baton Rouge, Louisiana in 2019 while working for the Navy and found a Royal Quiet Deluxe typewriter. He was instantly smitten.
It's everything. It's from the sight, the sound. It's, you know, when you type on something, it's deliberate, it's with intention, and it's, you're taking your thoughts and putting it on paper, and no one can take that away, right? And it's also tangible at the same time.
That started his collection, and then learning how to repair them. Now retired, he and his wife moved to Rolla to be close to family. And these old typewriters went from being a hobby to being part of a community to a business. In May, they opened Clickety Clack Typewriters, where they sell and service machines, including some that are more than 100 years old. Amanda Byrne is pursuing an online master's degree in creative writing, and she says typing on a computer or a phone just doesn't compare.
They're very two-dimensional. It's very flat. You put something out in the cloud, and it just kind of goes away, and you just really hope that it's still there when you log in the next time. But with a typewriter, you have the touch, the feel of it, the weight of your hands. You have the sound. You have the smell of the ink.
In addition to selling and fixing typewriters, the Burns host type-ins at community events where enthusiasts and the curious can try out typewriters. The Burns say Clickety Clack Typewriters has so far been more about covering their costs and building a community than it has been about making money. But they love bringing more people to manual typewriters, one keystroke at a time.
In Rolla, I'm Jonathan All, St. Louis Public Radio.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next week. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.